Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Dean Richards' pushover tries. The Underwoods mass screaming joyously in the stands. Martin Johnson, Mary McAleese and all that. A 50-point trimming back in the year 2000. Tom Court having his nose buried in the Twickenham turf in 2012.
He's the best club in the world!
Not Tom Court in that particular occasion.
I'm trying to put the frighteners up the Irish rugby public here, Murph. I feel there's far too much of a laissez-faire attitude around this trip to Twickenham on Saturday, so I'm trying to just present a few apocalyptic images from over the
You're
years.
Doing God's work.
Will I go on?
No, I mean,
Manu Tulagi bulldozing through us in Dublin in 2019, ending our Grand Slam defence on opening weekend and putting the shits up us in World Cup year.
Yeah.
Tulagi and his mates then further twisting the knife in the World Cup warm-up when they put 57 points past.
I do remember that day. That was an uncomfortable and...
Yeah, there was a bit of, a World Cup warm-up. Yeah, but you shouldn't lose. You know, we're at a different stage. We've been training hard over in the fucking Algarve. Okay. I still don't want to lose by 57 points to the same team that absolutely destroyed our confidence earlier this year.
Yeah, I'm going
to
say that was still a bad sign. And so it proved, though. I was gobsmacked as well, Tony, to be honest.
What more do people need to snap out of the smugness that is enveloping this nation and start feeling scared about what makes us
no fans.
On Saturday afternoon. What was that one?
We've got no fans. We've got fans. They just prefer to talk about mortgage and life insurance policies.
Okay, let's play the voice of Nigel Starmer-Smith. This always sends a shudder up my spine.
England come again. Carling, Webb, OT, bidding for the hat-trick.
No, not this
England.
One.
Oh. Shadows him all the way, but there's a tackle and OT is in. OT is there for the hat-trick.
He's got the hat-trick there.
Do you know what's notable about this particular performance? Well, 1988.
You told me earlier in the day, but do you want me to feign surprise when you tell me?
Feign surprise when I tell our non-members.
I'm none the wiser. I haven't a clue.
The Chris Oatey hat-trick in 1988 was the match that launched Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
No.
Apparently a few schoolboys in the crowd got so excited by the third try going in that they launched into Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and thereby, from then on, I should say, got adopted as the unofficial.
Absolutely unbelievable.
Unofficial. I mean, it's basically their official rugby anthem. Not their national anthem, but their rugby anthem.
Yeah.
For sure. Today's podcast is England against Ireland in the rugby. We're probably going to win. That's what everyone's saying.
Literally everyone. Might we lose? Not me, but everyone else.
We'll see. Yesterday, Miguel and Jonathan put their thinking caps on about why the Champions League has lost its appeal in recent times and what could be done to get it back.
Well, let's start with the teams who aren't there. So some of the most interesting teams in Europe this season are Bayer Leverkusen, not in the Champions League. Liverpool, not in the Champions League. Girona, not in the Champions League. So three teams who led their domestic leagues in January aren't in the competition. That's slightly freakish. So they've been unfortunate in that sense. But at the same time, the clubs who are there, you've had a massive decline from the Spanish and Italian champions. So Barcelona versus Napoli should be this mouthwatering clash in the last 16. The first leg was pretty drab, was pretty ordinary football. There's this sort of irony as well that the Premier League domination, which is one of the problems, that all the resources or a huge proportion of resources being sucked to England, which weakens every other nation. Maybe not Real Madrid, maybe not Bayern, but it weakens Spanish teams, Italian teams, everybody else. Well, you know, the counter argument to that is, oh, well, how come two English teams went out? Mm-hmm. Well, because Manchester United and Newcastle are rubbish. Yeah, they've had terrible seasons. So you might have a, you know, slightly more intrigue at this stage had it been, you know, Villa and Tottenham who got through into the Champions League, rather than the teams who are, what, sixth and ninth are they at the minute, Manchester United, Newcastle. Mm. Yeah, it's this is not proof of the Premier League not being dominant. It's proof of two teams who are in the Premier League playing quite badly this season. And that, with Barcelona and Napoli's collapse, means that four of the slots should go to kind of really good sides have gone to teams who really aren't very good. And we say, well, in the case of two of them, we can say with absolute certainty won't win it. I'd be amazed if either Barcelona or Napoli, whoever comes through that tie, goes on to win it. And so it all just feels a little bit futile. I mean, I was sitting there watching Lazio Bayern v Lazio last night. And there's part of me thinking, in that first sort of 20 minutes or so when Bayern were missing chances, oh, yeah, we'd be quite good if Lazio got through. But then there's a much bigger bit of me going, no, because Lazio are no good at all. They're not going to win it. They're not going to challenge Manchester City or...
Yeah, well, that's a key point on that. I mean, and the absence of kind of strong Premier League teams, as Jonathan points out there, has exposed the gaps elsewhere. And if they're not there, suddenly there's this drop-off, or even worse. Like, and like the great frustration when you watch a Lazio or a Napoli like that. And like, Napoli obviously had that revelation last year, but really, like, Napoli winning the title shouldn't be a revelation in the way it was. But it's the knowledge that these clubs aren't what they should be. And they're not what they should be because of bad running or bad management. They're like that because of the way the game is structured, that they can't reach the same scope. And like, I mean, and that sort of that concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer pockets leaves kind of so much of football looking stale. I mean, if you look at like Cheffrin, it's sort of amazing. 2016 was another point where Platini had left UEFA and there was a vacuum of power. And in that vacuum, before Cheffrin got in, the big clubs actually there was another vote to basically engineer a bit more of the prize money for themselves. But Cheffrin was brought in and supposed to be on the basis of being favourable to small associations. Instead, what actually happened? He got into power. He becomes friendly with Agnelli, and look what happened there. And now he's friendly with Nasser, whose main priority is to answer to the Emir of Qatar. But he's also overseen a situation where, despite European football generating so much money, it generates billions. Most, I think, it's something like over 50% of that, of those billions, are concentrated in something like seven urban pockets. And like, in terms of at least competing at any sort of decent level, east of Munich is a football wasteland, and increasingly a lot of west of Munich is as well, including Italy.
Yeah, you look at Inter. So, you know, Inter obviously got the final last year. I've been told by people, Inter, maybe Inter is the second best team in Europe. And then, you know, I watched the last 16 game, and you're thinking, hang on, they relied on Marko Arnautovic, the bloke who wasn't quite good enough for Stoke, to kind of get the winner. How has that happened? Yeah, even the final last season, you know, you sort of think, well, maybe Inter are quite good. But who's their centre forward? Edin Dzeko against City, who got rid of Dzeko for not being good enough 9 years ago. So yeah, you know, it just the sense of you know, when Europe was at its height, when European football really had cachet, was this sense of a quest.
Yeah.
And then those days sort of they faded away. But you got that period we were talking about sort of 5 to 10 years ago, when okay, it's not the same sense of a quest. It's not the same sense of you have to go and defeat all these monsters before getting to the Grail. Mm. But it was at least 8-10 of these teams are really, really good. And when they bang into each other, it's really worth watching. And now that's faded away. Now, Miguel made the point about poor management. And I semi-agree with him. But one of the problems we've got is that even if you are badly managed, Barcelona, for instance, you're still guaranteed your place in this competition because of the way that the economic structures work. But you can't actually challenge to win it. And so all that does is you're creating deadwood. And and that means that there's a lot of games in the Champions League. They're just sort of a bit, what's the point?
Before Ken comes in, just pick up. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, you can still get decent groups. You know, the Newcastle, Dortmund, PSG, Milan group. That was still a fun group.
Manchester United, don't forget them. That was
Manchester United's group as well. Amazing. But the Newcastle group, one of the reasons that, I mean, I think United's group was interesting for the specific reason that Copenhagen actually a little bit better than their coefficient and their budget suggests they should be, and United were worse. Newcastle's group was interesting because Newcastle sort of defied the coefficient system by not having they haven't built up any coefficient points over the previous 10 to 15 years. And so they're ranked artificially low. So you do occasionally get situations where the coefficient almost should guarantee boredom. Occasionally it breaks down and you get interest.
Hmm.
But the consequence now is, it just feels, it's going to be City or Arsenal, surely, maybe Real Madrid. But beyond those three, anybody else to win it, I'd say, would be the weakest Champions League winner in, 20 years, 25 years?
And just before Ken comes in, that point, and I suppose I touched on a little bit with what Napoli are, like the great mystique of European football, and maybe this is come back to like an element of nostalgia, or it's getting old, but I think it's what European football should be about. The idea that you could watch a team from outside the established countries or outside the established powers, and not just that they could have a team that can compete or play kind of counter-attacking football to make it, but actually they could have a vibrant, exciting team, and wow, that actually is one of the best in Europe. And instead we're in a situation where even by just competing with Bayern for a title, Bayer Leverkusen suddenly hailed as this revelation, something they did actually like 20 years ago in getting to the final. And that's now actually been completely lost. And like, we're beyond the point where we're talking about Dynamo Kiev as one of the great, exciting teams in Europe. Now it's like, even the idea of Leeds and Valencia playing in a semi-final, a club from England and a club from Spain playing in a semi-final, where both are, they're not just good teams, like they're really substantial challenges for the competition. That's almost impossible now.
Yeah. And the problem with Leverkusen, by the time they get into the Champions League next season, almost certainly Xabi Alonso's gone, and probably a handful of players as well. So they're not even the Leverkusen that are exciting and challenging Bayern, and what, probably going to win the title in Germany this season. That we've created this structure where these exciting minnows are crushed and stripped for parts immediately. It just feels very repetitive. The same teams plodding through. It feels like the same. City play Leipzig every year and it's never good. It just keeps happening. Porto play Atletico every season and that's never good. These repeated fixtures and this sense of diminishing returns, partly because we're familiar with these games, partly because the gaps between these sides, who were quite level 5 years, 10 years ago, are becoming bigger and bigger, and therefore the interest is becoming less and less.
Is there anything that UEFA can actually do to reverse what's happening here?
Solutions, guys, solutions.
Well, funny enough, on specifically that, I mean, obviously they need to have kind of a das Kapital for football, really. Cheffrin's never going to do that. And neither is anyone.
A revolution? Like, what do you mean by das Kapital?
Well, like they need it basically to completely overhaul the economic structure of football, and in terms of kind of where money goes. But you can actually, there are actually ways to significantly address that without even doing that. And one is, rather than redistributing money, it's redistributing players.
Yeah.
And this is where having like worked on a lot of stuff like this for the book, it's funny how, anti-competition law in Europe has actually created a massive anti-competition problem within sport.
Is this the problem? That, like, actually, what you need is foreigner rules. Like, you need foreigner rules.
The old foreign player rule, 6 + 3 + 2, actually solves multiple problems at a stroke, because by definition, it just ensures... So, like, because there's many, say, Legia Warsaw or whatever, because there's many Polish players can't just leave, or they can't be accumulated by England or wherever, more of the better players have to stay. It just slows that spread of players down, and sure, more of the quality is spread. And it's like the amount of people that now say it would instantly solve a lot of issues. They probably can't do that because of... Actually, that's not anti-competition law. That's more
freedom of movement
in Europe. Yeah. But what you can do, and what I know FIFA are looking at ever since they failed in this attempt to reform agents, maybe look at it going in the opposite direction, where clubs would have to play a certain amount of homegrown players, by the truest definition of homegrown, coming through their club. And because obviously it's also in the EU's interest to encourage it training up.
Yeah, but Miguel, the problem with that is that this is exactly what is not incentivized through financial fair play and profit and sustainability regulations. Your Mason Mounts and all these guys are sold for pure profit, and you're actually incentivized to sell your young local homegrown players.
Yeah, and that is one of a few issues of those current kind of cost controllers. Now, I think they have been improved with the new system that UEFA brought in and the Premier League going to follow it. But clearly, I mean, it's always been an issue with FFP, that it was never complemented by any sort of competitive balance mechanism. So it kind of locked things in place. But then, of course, without any sort of cost control, and this, I think this is a point always worth stressing when people bring this up, without any sort of cost control, the game actually becomes less competitive, not more, because what's going to happen? City and PSG are going to spend whatever they want. Newcastle are going to spend whatever they want, and people can't compete with that. And worse, and this is why FFP was actually brought in the first place, it's not so much to control or to kind of keep clubs in, it's that because of that wage race, we know for a fact, we've seen it, Leeds being the classic case, that clubs will basically overextend themselves trying to keep up. And one of the reasons actually FAIR was in the original FFP name in the first place wasn't to do with competitive balance. It was because of basically the knowledge that a lot of clubs would agree, say, a £25 million deal for a player, knowing they could pay for the first instalment, but really hoping they're going to be able to pay for the next two. And that was seen, that was where the fairness idea came from. And it's why some form of cost control is essential in football, because the wage race is probably the most corrosive thing in the game. But it does clearly need improvement. And one of those, as you say, Owen, is to address this issue of incentivizing the sale of young players. And this is where I think encouraging a rule where a certain amount of players have to be homegrown actually helps. And it also begins to anchor clubs back into the community, especially in something like the Premier League, which is now this, I mean, it's basically global capitalism in sporting form. This kind of mess of different structures and these kind of multinational things that are only kind of vaguely linked to their communities, but the fans go there and invariably get very angry. There's a lot to sort there.
Do you know two countries that do have caps on foreign players? Saudi Arabia and Russia, which is it's good to hear yourself.
Are these guys leaving
yourself with MBS and.
But do you disagree, John? I mean,
No, I don't. I'm just pointing out the irony of it. I mean, Russia actually have relaxed their regulations. I think it was, I can't remember if it was six Russians and five foreigners or the other way around, but it's now down to, you can have up to eight foreigners, purely because there's less money there, so they're desperately trying to recruit people, and they're desperately trying to sort of make it more exotic and raise the level. But I was talking to somebody who was high up at Zenit when they won the UEFA Cup in 2008. And yeah, there's a moment then when it looked like a Russian club could conceivably join, you know, that very, very elite group, because of the amount of money that, you know, Gazprom, for instance, were willing to spend. I mean, yeah, this is going off at the time, but what reasons that no Russian club did kick on? I mean, I think, yeah, essentially a lack of expertise, a lack of understanding of capitalist markets, a lack of marketing expertise, which is as understandable given that, you know, a lot of clubs were effectively state-run back then. FFP absolutely hammered them, which was not the intention. It was an unintended consequence, but, you know, they clearly couldn't spend to the level that they thought they might be, or to the level that Abramovich had spent at Chelsea. But it was the foreign regulation meant that they couldn't bring in the players they'd like to bring in, players that financially they could afford to bring in. And also they kept tweaking the regulations. So I think Zenit had a deal in place to sign Jaime Moutinho and Radamel Falcao, and had to cancel both of those because suddenly the foreign regulation changed.
Yeah, there's a quote here from Florentino Perez. He may be, I don't know if he's listening today, but probably he's nodding along. You know, I was right about a lot of stuff. He says, this quote is from a little while ago, but I thought it was interesting, the point that he raised. I mean, he was having a go at the Swiss system, you know, which he calls an absurd idea. It's an absurd competition. But he goes on to say, UEFA doesn't innovate. It doesn't know how to deal with the threat of other sports which keep growing, above all American sports. We've seen many examples of large corporations that seemed invincible but ended up going bankrupt because they weren't able to adapt. So he seems to be comparing UEFA and, you know, maybe sort of the Champions League to like Kodak or Nokia or one of these types of companies that, you know, got sort of found out by the changing market, let's say. But the point he raised about US sports, are US sports really that much of a threat to European football? I mean, it seems to me as though the direction of conquest, that you could say, is more football into the United States rather than U.S. sports to the rest of the world, and also U.S. money into European football. I mean, we've just seen, Miguel, today the announcement of new American investment into St. Patrick's Athletic. You know, there's some high profile people associated with this, Joe Flacco, and I don't know, a few rich people in America putting money into St. Pat's. You're thinking, what?
Yeah.
Why do you, the question I suppose here really is, why do you think there's this wall of money coming out of America, which, given all the stuff that we've just been moaning about, they seem to think that this European football, even, you know, League of Ireland club, is a winning bet.
It's for the same reason football is here in the first place, I suppose, that it is very, at its core, a great game to watch, easy to pick up, and has this immense global popularity and this vitality. Now, we're speaking about it from a point of view where we've been conscious of these long-term trends for a while and can see where it's going from like what it used to be. A lot of these interests are obviously kind of just seeing what is still right now. I mean, it's not just a massively popular sport. There's a strong argument it's the most popular cultural pursuit there's ever been in history. I think that's a word we've used on the podcast, or phrase we've used before, but it's probably true. And so they're seeing that and basically seeing, how can we make money out of this? There's a few other elements there in that, and this should be a warning for football, really, in that one of the reasons they're investing in European football is because they can't invest in American sports. There's all sorts of caps and restrictions, particularly on private equity. So what do? They look around the world and see this massively popular thing. Well, let's have a go at that. And of course, the more that comes in, and there are arguments, actually, it's creating a bubble as well, especially in terms of private equity, because they have to go further and further out in terms of clubs and what they can buy. And as they invest, they seek to and are actively changing the sport and the makeup of the sport, and also the impetus in the sport as well. It's funny, like I was at last Thursday, the Financial Times put on their Business of Football conference, which is, it's a really interesting event. It's good for the FT to put it on as an event, especially given what they cover as a paper. And it's a great event in terms of who's there, like it's interesting. But
Zlatan, I think, and heads like that were there, yeah.
60% of the crowd are basically, it's exactly this American quote unquote institutional money. And like I was talking to a football executive there who would be of a more traditionalist bent and kind of the idea of football as community clubs. And he was pointing out to me that they were, he was talking to a guy from Goldman Sachs who said, he's like, oh yeah, it's a great time to invest in the game. And he just goes to them, why? And they couldn't really answer beyond, well, we can make money out of it. And I know like people hear that and kind of, I suppose, wonder, well, what's the problem with that? Well, the issue then is, I mean, football is at heart. It's a community sport. I mean, but how did football happen? Clubs grew out of communities and played football to represent their communities in games that are feasibly like supposed to be exciting or competitive. I mean, 100 years ago, somehow the Football League, say, realized they needed to have all sorts of measures in place to prevent big city clubs becoming too powerful. So, which is why England was so, in terms of winners, so democratic for a century. But and now we have this point where all of that is being eroded by basically the impetus of seeking to make money goes against what football is supposed to be, which essentially clubs represent the community and also engaging in a sport that is competitive. Like the two can temporarily align in terms of kind of like sometimes this, like look at Liverpool, say, where putting out a winning team in the way they have done will actually serve what the fans want and what the club should be. But that can only ever be temporary. And I think we saw the consequence of that in the Super League.
Yeah. And also a lot of FSG out stuff, which happens whenever they lose like a couple of games in a month. Jonathan, last word to you there. Do you think all these American investors are going to get their fingers burned?
I mean, possibly. I think they see football as being incredibly attractive because they look at sort of memberships and fan bases, and they compare them to franchises in the US, and they're much bigger, and yet they make less money out of them. And yeah. So I think there's a feeling that may or may not be accurate that fans are ripe for the monetizing. That there's a lot more money that's not being gouged out of spectators.
But there's a contradiction there as well. So, and it's core to why football is so valuable as well. So one of the reasons that all these US clubs are so valuable is, of course, because they're all in closed systems, meaning there's a guarantee of income. Whereas football inherently has promotion, relegation, potentially getting into Europe, all these potential variances reduces the value of the club. So they see that, I think, and a lot of them now are saying, seeing it like an Ipswich and thinking they can bring an Ipswich up. And suddenly you're buying a championship club, you're making them the equivalent of an NFL club, say. But those two can never align unless we actually see like elements like closed leagues.
Which is my fear with if you get a critical mass of US owners, could they have the voting rights to actually create some kind of closed league, whether that's within England, whether it's within Europe. I mean, I still don't explain to me why people are buying the St. Pat's, and I guess people in the Irish game maybe can understand that better than me. But my fear there would be that, actually, I mean, I was going to speculate wildly. I shouldn't do that, so I won't.
Oh, wow.
Well, I mean...
Is that a cliffhanger? No, will we end on the cliffhanger?
Okay.
You might as well.
What I was going to say is, I don't know anything about them, so, you know, I don't want to say this is what they're doing, because but I'm just sort of thinking, if you're private equity in the US and you're buying a club in Dublin, are you thinking that there could be some sort of, you know, Northwest Europe Super League, some kind of, you know, Britain and Ireland Super League, in which case there would be, if it's franchise, yeah, you would definitely have a Dublin franchise.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Timbuktu.
Yo, listen up. Here's the story.
An old pumpkin.
A little guy that lives in a blue world.
We haven't got leaders.
All day and all night, and everything he sees is just blue.
They're all just headphones.
Inside and outside, blue.
They don't communicate.
You can't get anything out of them.
That's why we're no good.
Timbuktu.
They're all just headphones.
They don't communicate on the pitch. They don't communicate off the pitch.
They're all pumpkin.
Oh, we're getting ready for Russia. Good luck.
And then after that, we'll be building a team for Timbuktu.
Timbuktu.
How have England reacted to that equaliser?
Perfectly. No panic. Calm straight down. Continue dominating the game, playing and staying in Iceland's heart. It's been the perfect response. You'd think that no problem.
England after 4 minutes. And they still lost.
Maggie Thatcher, your guys took a hell of a beating.
Maggie Thatcher, your boys took a hell of a beating.
The only thing that they have got is the big boy up front, Sigurdsson, who really, Sigthorsson.
Oh my word. Tell us, talk us through that, Steve. I think we know what's happened.
Oh, just say, Sigthorsson.
He just cannot.
Over in Indianapolis on Sunday, a trio of GA goalkeepers took their best shot at winning a spot on an NFL roster. Rory Began, Mark Jackson and Charlie Smith took their talents to the Lucas Oil Stadium for the NFL Combine. We caught up with Began, the Monaghan goalkeeper, on Tuesday, by which time he was supposed to be back in Ireland, but there had been a change of plans.
We were due to fly home this evening, actually. And funny enough, that was still the case Sunday night after the combine, but I think come Monday morning we were asked about our availability to stay for a couple of weeks, because I think we had an interview process on Sunday morning before the kick-in with all 32 teams, and it was like a speed dating round where you go 10 minutes at a table with, and at that table there could have been about 6 or 7 NFL coaches. And a good few of the questions came up, like, you know, what is your process after the combine? Like, where are you staying? Or, you know, what's your plan, training plan and stuff? And we were just telling the truth. You know, we're like, we're flying back home to Ireland on Tuesday. And you could see that they're a wee bit, so what'll happen if, you know, we want to take you out and fly you out and stuff? And we were like, yeah, well, we have visas to clear that. We don't have to go through a big visa process again. We have a B1, B2 visa that we can fly straight back out, and the IPP will work with us on that. But I think after all that, there was a bit of communication in between the head of the special teams who ran the showcase and the IPP program to say, look, I think it's best he's by stay out for a few more weeks. So we're here till potentially 27th of March, just to, I suppose, be available if a club wanted to fly us out. to maybe work out in their campus, or if clubs wanted to visit the AMG and watch all the kickers again and do a training session. So I think it's more efficient, obviously, to have us still here training away professionally. And, you know, if some club picks up the phone, that we're available to jump out.
Yeah.
Jump in and go at it. So.
Oh, for sure. It's a good sign, I think. I mean, I saw Tadhg Leader going so far as to say that he says, I think a couple of the lads are going to be getting signed to contracts in the next 2 to 6 weeks. That sounds exciting.
Yeah. I'm not hiding anything from you. We haven't heard a thing yet about offers or that. Like, my phone this morning, any word. Like, we've heard nothing. We've heard, there's been interest, obviously, in the kickers. In terms of her performance, maybe on Sunday, that maybe went above their expectations. So I'm sure that they will want to see us in a more enclosed environment, one-to-one more so. So I'd imagine there will be a bit of movement in the next few days in terms of contact and stuff. But at the minute, there's been no formal contact from any teams yet. So, and I think everybody else is in the same boat.
You are free agents, though, so you can be signed at any time from now until the season starts in September. I mean, and also, you don't necessarily have to wait for the draft either. So, I mean, yeah, it is that kind of situation that Owen has outlined that you guys have talked about. It's, you know, you're keeping your phone on for the next couple of days.
Yeah, keeping it well charged and good coverage and that. So, yeah, we can be signed at any time. We don't have to wait until the April draft, which is positive. But you know yourself, you'd like contact sooner rather than later, so you can start planning again. We're heading home, as I said, definitely anyway on the 27th of March, unless something happens before that. So you'd like to maybe have word while you're still in the country if you know you're going to be flying out anywhere, or you're in good contention. Ooh. Instead of having to go home and fly back home again nearly. So it'll be an interesting couple of days ahead, couple of weeks ahead, but we definitely made a good impression to them, so I imagine there will be contact made.
Great.
If it's not me, it's definitely going to be to one of the other ways anyway.
I must say, Murph, that all sounds very promising.
Yeah, it does. Like, a lot more promising than I think any of us really had been thinking. I mean, this story's been rumbling along since probably November, maybe even earlier. Yeah. Niall Morgan was ruled out of this. That feels like that could have been September or October. So this has been rolling along. But I don't really think anyone has been... I think we're tuning in this week to just how insane it would be for a GAA player to end up taking even one shot at goal in the NFL as a kicker.
Yeah.
I mean, there are 16,000 high school football teams in America.
Well, don't forget that the hot shot, Dan Whedon, he played Gaelic, I think. He's a punter.
Well, he's a punter, but I mean, he played high school football, American football.
He moved off to America as a
13-year-old. I mean, I'm not demeaning that achievement. That achievement is outrageous. It's absolutely amazing. But for... So there are 16,000 high school teams in America. Then there's college football. Every single kicker that's gone through the NFL has gone through both of those, you'd have to say, pretty extensive formative experiences. And for three lads from Ireland to go to the NFL combine and for not to be like, yeah, lads, thanks for your service, good luck, you know, it is genuinely crazy. I mean, I'll still believe it when I see it, one of them actually does end up kicking in the NFL, but to have even gotten this far. And again, it's like watching last Sunday, there were 7 other kickers at the NFL combine. That's it. You know, the 7 of the best kickers from college football. That's not to say there will be more than that drafted probably or brought on to practice squads. Not everyone goes to the NFL combine, but by the same token, it is...
No, that's good stuff.
It's incredible. Absolutely.
You were writing today that Rory Began... So when we were talking to him, he was... He sounded like he had boned up on the NFL to impress the employers over there, impress upon them the fact that he knows something about their sport. I mean, this might be a fairly recently acquired knowledge.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to put any words in anyone's mouth, but I do have some friends in the county of Monaghan. One of them did say that Rory Began wouldn't recognise Patrick Mahomes if Patrick Mahomes walked up while wearing a Mahomes 15 Kansas City Chiefs jersey, shook his hand, said, "I'm Patrick Mahomes, 3-time Super Bowl champion," and booted Rory Began up the arse. He still doesn't reckon Rory Began would know who Patrick Mahomes was. I think that may have been the case at some unspecified point in the past. But that is not the case.
Patrick Mahomes hanging out with Sia Khaleesi and Jurgen Klopp this week. But that's a story for another day. Yeah.
I did see those photographs. Yeah. Rather odd.
Sign up to the World Service to hear our chat with Rory Began in full for 5 euro a month plus VAT. You'll hear Shane Horgan on the England-Ireland game at the weekend. And that Champions League chat that we played a good chunk of there, that got a big reaction. We get through some of that reaction on today's podcast. Thank you, Unai Emery. Listen to the second captains or whatever way Unai pronounced it. He's probably got it right. No ads if you sign up. The Second Captains podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Creator Network.
And that's really it. SecondCaptains.com. That's the website.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The Second Captains World Service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.